This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
It causes about 11 million avoidable deaths each year. Still, today, 670,000 neonatal deaths occur due to sepsis.
Rick Johnston of the World Health Organization on how the lack of basic hygiene services affects many healthcare facilities. Details coming up also. The renewed clashes between the Ethiopian government and Tigray forces has shattered a five-month-old truce. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Mikhail Gorbachev, who presided over the demise of the Soviet Union and helped end decades of Cold War fear, has died at age 91. His role in the end of the Cold War between the communist Soviet Union and the capitalist Western nations earned him a Nobel Peace Prize and the lasting enmity of millions of Russians, bitter about the chaos unleashed by the collapse of the world's largest country. Ed Donahue from the Associated Press has more.
He was in power less than 7 years, but Gorbachev unleashed a breathtaking series of changes. It included the freeing of Eastern European nations from Russian domination and the toppling of the Berlin Wall. Years later, Gorbachev said the end of the Cold War was a moment in history for global cooperation and problem solving, but it didn't happen.
The West, and particularly the United States, declared victory in the Cold War. Euphoria and triumphalism went to the heads of Western leaders.
Gorbachev resigned in 1991. The Soviet Union later collapsed. News organizations quoted a statement saying Gorbachev died after a long illness. I'm Ed Donahue.
World leaders and diplomats are remembering Gorbachev, who rises to power in the Soviet Union, paved the way for a number of revolutionary changes that transformed Europe and parts of Africa. U.S. Ambassador Johnny Carson, former Secretary of State for the Bureau of African Affairs and a senior advisor at the United States Institute of Peace, says the institute mourns the death of Gorbachev, pointing out he tried to begin to transform the old Soviet Union. He tells VOA's Carol Van Damme that outside of the Soviet Union and Western Europe, the greatest impact of the collapse of the old Soviet system was felt in Africa.
Africa was a beneficiary of the collapse of the Soviet Union. The failure of the Soviet Union and its collapse demonstrated the weakness of the Soviet economic and political systems. It proved that the communist model of economic development was flawed and discredited, and its single-party, autocratic, non-democratic nature was also flawed and discredited. I think that after the collapse of the Soviet Union in December of 1991, we saw great change sweep across much of sub-Saharan Africa. We saw African governments discrediting the old Soviet state-dominated economic models. We saw governments liberalize their economies, open up their foreign exchange regimes. We saw them inviting in foreign companies, and we saw them dismantling the state-run corporations, many of these things modeled after the Soviet Union. We also saw a opening up in the democratic space as well, and we saw countries move away from these single-party systems, move away from one-party, single-party governments and single-party states. We saw an opening up of the democratic opportunities across Africa.
You know, going to that, the points you make, Ambassador Herman J. Cohen, who served as U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs under President George H.W. Bush, told VOA's James Buddy that Gorbachev should be remembered as a leader who played a real critical role in bringing peace to three countries in particular, Angola, Ethiopia, and Mozambique, all of which were, you know, undergoing civil wars at the time. Do you agree?
I think there were many hands in the effort to bring peace to the troubled former Portuguese territories. I think there were efforts underway by the United States, as Mr. Cohen would acknowledge, and also by countries in Western Europe. I think that the effort to bring about peace in all of those countries has a lot of fathers. I think that the failure to have made progress, of course, would have left the countries an orphan.
And when you say would have left those countries an orphan, can you elaborate a little
that
bit?
I would say that we would still see them struggling today. And I think that we are seeing genuine progress in some of the former Portuguese territories. We've just witnessed this past week elections in Angola, for example, where we saw the current government retain its prominence, but where we saw a surge in the popularity of the opposition party, UNITA, while the MPLA maintained its strong role in the parliament and maintained the presidency. We saw a real sharp uptick in support for UNITA.
That was Ambassador Johnny Carson, whose ambassadorship have included Kenya, Zimbabwe, and Uganda, and now is senior advisor at the USIP's Africa Center. He was speaking to my colleague Carol Van Dam. Authorities in Ethiopia's Tigray region have reported a fresh assault in Tigray's capital, Mekelle, that they say has hit a hospital and a center for displaced people. Meanwhile, Ethiopia's federal government said in a statement that fighting has spread to the west of Tigray near the border of Sudan. Henry Wilkins reports from Hawassa, Ethiopia.
Kiprom Gebreselassie, the chief clinical director at Mekelle's Ada Referral Hospital, said on Twitter that there was a drone attack close to midnight Wednesday near Mekelle General Hospital. He said casualties were arriving at Ada Hospital without giving details. Meanwhile, Getachew Reda, a spokesman for the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, said on Twitter that at least three bombs were dropped on Mekelle, with Mekelle Hospital being among the targets. He said there were no conceivable military targets in the area where the attack took place. Due to a telecommunications blackout in Tigray, it was impossible for VOA to confirm the accounts or learn the extent of the casualties. On Wednesday morning, the Ethiopian government issued a statement saying the TPLF had invaded the Amhara region near the border with neighbouring Sudan. Reda denied the allegation, saying the government of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is making up stories. A five-month ceasefire in Ethiopia's civil war came to an end last week, dashing hopes for peace talks. Each side has blamed the other for the renewed fighting. Meanwhile, Sudan's government has summoned Ethiopia's ambassador to Khartoum over an assertion he made that the Ethiopian military shot down a plane carrying weapons from Sudanese airspace. Sudan says the allegation was unfounded. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Hawassa, Ethiopia.
As Henry Wilkins reported, the renewed clashes between the Ethiopian government and the Tigray People Liberation Front, TPLF, have shattered a five-month-old truce and cast doubt over efforts to end the nearly two-year conflict in the north of Africa's second most populous country. William Davison is a senior analyst for Ethiopia at the Crisis Group. I asked him why peace talks between the two factions never materialized.
We've had very significant period of reduced fighting this year, really ever since the Tigray forces retreated to Tigray in December, and then that was consolidated by the truce a few months later. And then we've seen some increase in food aid delivery. But of course, none of the underlying political disagreements that led to the conflict have been addressed, let alone resolved. And also we've had major problems emerge during the conflict, such as the atrocities and Amhara region taking control of Western Tigray. On top of the failure to address those differences, or accompanying that, has of course been the failure to really get this peace process off the ground. Yes, two sides have had covert meetings, but we've had no internationally mediated formal negotiation. Now, on the surface, the reasons for that are the difference over the mediator. Tigray rejecting the African Union envoy Obasanjo was biased, and disagreement over the issue of restoring services and humanitarian access, with Tigray's government insisting that that is all facilitated prior to talks, and also referring repeatedly to the return to Tigray's pre-war borders as an obligation of the federal government. And instead, you know, although the position has, there have been different statements, you know, essentially the federal government has said that it's willing to turn up unconditionally for negotiations and discuss all of these issues there. And that was rejected by Tigray. So we have the context of a very volatile situation with nothing resolved. And so a very fragile truce, then accompanied by this failing peace process, the failure to get off the ground. That led to a renewed spike in tension, belligerent rhetoric and troop mobilization. And that was the context to this very worrying resumption of fighting that we've seen over the last week.
It's very hard to verify what's going on in that Tigray area because there's no access to media or anything. As far as you are concerned, has fighting actually begun? And who is attacking who?
Well, there's definitely been very serious clashes in northern Amhara, southern Tigray border areas. It's very hard for me to say authoritatively who fired the first shot, I'm afraid. And then in addition to that, we've also seen the Federal Air Force bomb targets in Mekele, allegations by the Tigray authorities that they hit civilian targets. There's some reports of clashes in western areas, as well as around Waghimra as well. So yes, there's various sort of ongoing active hostilities.
For these two factions to return back to peaceful negotiations, the underlying concerns and differences you were mentioning, what has to be rectified?
There has to be a step-by-step incremental process. There's nothing like, you know, a silver bullet to resolving this situation, as you and your listeners know. Obviously, we need to de-escalate, see a recommitment to a cessation of hostilities, and then both the parties need to think about their approach to the idea of getting negotiations underway. Can Tigray's government find a way of turning up for talks, formal internationally mediated talks, and make some of their demands there? What can the federal government do to alleviate the situation inside Tigray by improving, you know, humanitarian access, reconnecting Tigray to normal, vital public services and commercial traffic as a confidence building measure in advance of talks? And critically, the international actors here, the African actors, the African Union, need to swing into a far more concerted, urgent action than they've shown so far, realize the gravity of this renewed outbreak of conflict and the risk of escalation, insist on a recommitment to the truce, and do everything needed to get these talks convened as soon as possible, because that is the only way to move the parties away from the prospect of a return to all-out war. And it's the only way to get them into a position where they can start addressing some of the very difficult underlying political issues that are at the heart of the disagreements and the conflict.
That's William Davison, senior analyst for Ethiopia, the Crisis Group. He was talking to me from London. Employers in South Africa are disappointed and angry at the prospect of losing thousands of Zimbabwean workers. The government granted special work and residence permits to almost 200,000 Zimbabweans more than a decade ago, but it now says economic and political conditions in their home country have improved and they must return north by December. Darren Taylor has more.
A lot of the Zimbabweans are in South Africa because of political and economic turmoil in their home country. They're waiters, cooks, garden landscapers, builders, and much more.
This is a difficult path that lies ahead for these employees and the employers. You know, one must remember these are good employees.
Gerard Papenfuss is CEO at South Africa's National Employers Association. He speaks for thousands of individuals and businesses who've given jobs to the Zimbabweans.
Many of them have established them in workplaces. They occupy positions of trust in seniority, and to replace an employee with skill which has a good attitude, is very difficult. And, you know, if you have a good employee, that actually creates employment.
He says some employers are making legal representations to the government, fighting to keep their Zimbabwean workers. But the process is complicated and expensive, and small businesses cannot afford it. In South Africa, Zimbabweans in particular are highly regarded within the hotel, restaurant, and building sectors.
This is a very unfortunate situation. If you keep in mind that these workers were lured to South Africa in 2009, prior to the World Cup, for their skills, and we needed labor at the time in the hospitality industry and in construction. And now, 12 years later, they have established themselves in South Africa, married, have children, and now we want just to throw them out of the country. And, you know, the problem is it won't do anything to...
South Africa has the highest official unemployment rate in the world at almost 35%. But Papenfuss says cancelling work permits of 180,000 Zimbabweans won't make a dent in solving the jobs crisis. Instead of doing the hard work of formulating progressive economic policies to create employment, says Papenfuss, the government has resorted to a cheap public relations stunt.
These are good people, so I think we make a big mistake. It is immoral what we're doing. We send people back to a country where there's no future. And the question is, why did we invite them to South Africa in the first place? I think this is entirely the wrong move.
The right move, according to his association, would be for the government to target the millions of undocumented migrants in the country, especially those involved in crime. Papenfuss acknowledges many employers prefer giving jobs to Zimbabweans because some South Africans feel entitled to work even when they don't have the required skills and experience.
You need to go there and prove that you've got a good attitude, you're not entitled, and you're skilled, then you get a job. Any employer would choose the right person for the job. Unfortunately for South Africans, these guys come here and they work. And that's why employers love them and they want to retain their services.
South Africa's labor market is highly unionized. Workers are regularly on strike. But as Papenfuss points out, most Zimbabweans aren't interested in belonging to unions as long as employers treat them fairly. South Africa's Department of Home Affairs says fewer than 6,000 holders of Zimbabwean exemption permits have so far made representations to say why their documents should not be terminated. Proof, it says, that most want to return north. Not so, say human rights groups. Instead, the low figure shows most intend to stay in South Africa illegally, rather than suffering hopelessness in a Zimbabwe that remains economically ravaged. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Authorities in Namibia have confirmed a family of four German tourists and their pilot were killed when their plane crashed yesterday during takeoff in the country's northern Zambezi region. Vitalio Angula reports from Windhoek, Namibia.
Namibia's Ministry of Works and Transport says it is investigating what caused the six-seater Cessna 210 to crash shortly after takeoff, killing all five people on board. The ministry says the plane crashed on Tuesday afternoon near Impalila Island on the Zambezi River in the Kavango Zambezi Transfrontier Conservation Area. The plane was carrying four members of a German family on holiday. Namibian media report the pilot was South African. Ministry spokesman Julius Ngweda told VOA the plane belonged to a local company, Scenic Air, but could provide no further details. Scenic Air Managing Director Michael Botka said in a press release the cause of the crash is not known. Everyone at Scenic Air is devastated by this tragic event, read the release, and our deep heartfelt condolences go out to the families and friends who lost loved ones. Namibia's Police Chief Inspector Eliphas Kuinga told VOA authorities would release the names of the deceased after their next of kin were notified. Vitalio Angula for VOA News, Windhoek, Namibia.
A World Health Organization UNICEF global study of healthcare facilities finds half lack basic hygiene services, putting around 3.85 billion people at risk of infection and death. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The study is based on data from 40 countries representing 35% of the world's population. It presents an alarming picture of health facilities that lack water and soap for hand washing, have dirty toilets, and are unable to manage healthcare waste. It says the lack of safe water, sanitation, and basic hygiene services, known as WASH, in healthcare facilities can lead to many preventable deaths. Rick Johnston is WHO lead, WHO UNICEF Joint Monitoring Program for WASH. He says sepsis, a major cause of mortality globally, could be prevented by improving WASH services in healthcare.
It causes about 11 million avoidable deaths each year. And we know that in healthcare settings, sepsis mortality is linked to poor quality of care, including inadequate WASH. Still, today, 670,000 neonatal deaths occur due to sepsis. So there's a huge burden that could be improved right there.
Data show the situation tends to be better in hospitals than in smaller healthcare facilities. The WHO reports the 46 least developed countries lag most behind in hygiene services, with only 32% of healthcare facilities providing WASH services. Johnston says sub-Saharan Africa is the geographic region with the lowest coverage of basic services, about a third lower than globally.
I mentioned hand hygiene services at 51% globally. It's only 38% in sub-Saharan Africa. Water services, 78% globally, only 52% in sub-Saharan Africa. But in sub-Saharan Africa, only 13% of healthcare facilities met the requirement for a basic healthcare service. So, yeah, lots of work to be done in sub-Saharan Africa.
The WHO estimates the cost of achieving universal basic WASH services in the 46 least developed countries at less than $10 billion between now and 2030. While that sounds like a lot, WHO officials say it comes to just under $1 per person per year. Officials say that is a fraction of what currently is being spent on healthcare services in those countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In northwestern Nigeria, 8 people have been pulled from a rubble of a 3-story building that collapsed yesterday in Kano State, and rescuers are searching for more victims in the remains of the 3-story business center. Officials say at least one person has died and 6 persons with minor injuries have been treated and discharged from a local hospital. The building was under construction, but many shops were open on the first floor. The Associated Press says Nigerians on social media are urging the government to take action against what they say is a trend of building collapses. The Associated Press says 10 buildings buckled in the last year, half of them in Lagos. In November, 40 people in the commercial capital were killed when a high-rise under construction gave way. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest development on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Frederick, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week, right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station.